Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now please join me in welcoming my co-host, Andy the Tattoo Smirk.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm well. How are you, Andy?
I am not a tattoo artist.
But people with tattoos have been in the news lately, I understand. Sandra Bullock's husband and his mistress?
His friend, yeah. What an awful story. It completely broke my heart. I'm a big fan of Sandra Bullock, and this guy, Jesse James, he did it wrong.
Well, you know, you could get a tattoo of a heart with Sandra's name in the middle of it.
I don't know if he has enough room left on his
Andy, if you're this broken up about it.
I guess so.
Do you have a tattoo?
I have no tattoos. I actually have a strict anti-tattoo policy.
Applying to just yourself or other people?
Well, I guess I'm the only one in charge of myself, so yeah, just myself.
But let's say, like, back in the day when you were dating, even before you were married, like, was the strict no tattoo policy, like, you would not date anybody that had a tattoo as well?
I have dated one or two girls with
tattoos. Oh, interesting. And when you're a father someday, and, you know, your son or daughter wants to have a tattoo, will you have a strict no tattoo policy?
Absolutely, no doubt about that, yeah.
And how are you going to enforce that one?
I don't know. And I have a child on the way, and this is what keeps me up at night.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But how do you, if they come home at 16 and say, look at this heart tattoo I got on my ankle, isn't it cute?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
I don't know. You got a big eraser, I guess.
Another thing to worry about.
All right, Andy. Well, I'm glad that you are back. Rick, we're not sure where Rick is. Rick has gone rogue, but we think he might be out there on his book tour. You know, I feel a little bad for Rick. I mean, I think his book's doing well. You know, ASCD picked it up and sent it to all their members. But Diane Ravitch's book, that is doing well. New York Times bestseller list, I understand.
I follow her on Twitter, and I mean, every day she reminds people that these books are sold out and they can't be found everywhere.
Yeah.
Even on Amazon, apparently.
It's a phenomenon.
I guess so.
But Andy has a book coming out. It's going to do the same thing. We'll talk about it when it comes out, but it's going to sell like hotcakes also.
Oh, I can't wait.
All right. But we got a lot to cover here and now. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. Then, of course, we're going to hear Amber's Research Minute. And then we're going to hear Rate That Reform.
Yep.
And it's going to be Janie this time instead of Stafford. Stafford is playing producer today. Laura's homesick. We are all pitching in here.
She's on the ones and twos.
That's right. Producer. So let's get started. Marissa, with your debut on the Education Gadfly Show, intern Marissa, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
The release of the Common Core standards has brought with it debate on many sides. Many Republicans have argued against the standards, contending that they will centralize education, increase federal oversight, and reduce school choice. There is also pushback from states like Massachusetts and Texas, which argue that their adoption of standards would result in weaker standards that they have now. Where do you fall among these charges?
Why don't you go first, Mike?
First of all, I mean, let's take up Texas. That their standards would be lower than? Hard to do that, folks in Texas. Now, I shouldn't give them such a grief. We haven't looked at the very latest version of some of Texas's standards, so maybe they're better than they used to be. But Texas is home to low standards historically. And so now Massachusetts has a harder case here. They've got some excellent standards across the board. And so that might be one of the states where it makes sense to keep doing what they've been doing, which is clearly working as well. But yeah, so there's a big debate on the right about national standards. You know, there's no surprise. We here at Fordham have been very strongly supportive of the idea of common standards. And we came out just this week with our own review of those draft standards, and they look pretty good.
So I think there are two different questions embedded in here, and both are actually kind of interesting. So on the first score, when it comes to states, there are states like Massachusetts and California, which is very proud of their math standards, who could make the case eventually down the road that the common standards are good, but they just don't measure up. So what happens then when a state actually can make a case that common standards in theory are good, but the hoary practice we have, 150 years of states coming up with their own standards, actually makes sense in their cases. The second issue is very few people are talking about the fact that most states were opposed to national standards until it came to Race to the Top, and Race to the Top is providing a whole bunch of money if states embrace national common standards. And the reason states did that is because they need money. They're desperately in need of money, and so they're willing to play ball to get a chunk of this money. They have to if they want to be eligible. But the question that I keep raising is, all right, what happens when Race to the Top money goes away and that enticement is no longer there, and all the states that have signed on and say, yeah, we'll do it, now that the federal government isn't holding a carrot out anymore, they can say, now that we've thought about it, maybe we're not going to sign on.
Yeah, but see, Andy, I would disagree with your analysis that it was Race to the Top that drove this. I mean, I think it was a big factor, and it provided political cover for state leaders to come forward and to say, okay, we're going to look and consider doing this. I think now we've got a situation where there's some political cover, there's some momentum, and even if the money went away at this point, I think you'd see plenty of states, especially in smaller states with less capacity at the state level, saying, yeah, absolutely, let's do this thing.
As I've been researching Race to the Top, the thing that has really come across to me is the fact that how many states were willing to do things just because of the money, and there are all kinds of quotes from state leaders. If you look at, say, California or Michigan, states that were willing to make the biggest legislative changes, it's not because they really necessarily love the legislative changes, it's because they had the nation's biggest deficits, and they needed this Race to the Top money.
Okay, Marissa, question number two.
Stories of schools banning bake sales and sodas to fight childhood obesity have saturated the media recently. Michelle Obama herself leads the charge to revamp school lunch and to get kids moving. But a new study shows that these school-age interventions may come too late in students' lives. Instead, interventions should aim to alter patterns of healthy living established as early as pregnancy. In light of this research, do you think that costly and time-consuming school interventions are futile?
First of all, Andy, do you worry that your unborn child is fat?
It hasn't crossed my mind, so I can add that to the list of things to worry about. Oh, my heavens. I mean, this is actually interesting, because this reminds me of the bigger, bolder, what do they call that? I mean, the people who
bigger,
say...
Bigger, bolder, fatter?
No, the folks who say that, you know, schools don't matter. The only way we're going to fix education problems is if we fix poverty problems. And this is kind of in the same line that schools can't do that much. What we really have to do is have a whole panoply of preschool programs and, I guess, pre-birth programs to deal with obesity. I don't know. I have a high sense of efficacy. I believe that people can change their lives at just about any time, and I think schools can play a big role in that. So I do less hand-wringing about this, I guess, than most people.
Ah, Andy, Mr. Pollyanna here. People don't change, Andy. Don't you know that? People don't change. Well, I think this is really interesting that there's a lot of things that schools should be doing just because they're worth doing. I mean, yes, we should serve kids healthy food.
Yep.
Okay, we should get them to... you know, exercise and PE and at recess. I mean, these are things that are worth doing anyway. But we shouldn't kid ourselves into thinking that that's going to make a big dent in this obesity epidemic. I mean, like everything else, when it comes to kids, so much of it comes back to parents. Maybe the goal here has got to be more long-term and intergenerational, which is to say, you know, you might have kids who are obese today, and we do what we can to help them. But the main goal is to try to educate them in such a way that it's less likely that their own kids will be obese the next time around. Topic number three.
We're all for transparency, and some of the parents in Arizona's Congress Elementary School District seem to be taking that message to heart. A small group has filed almost 1,000 Freedom of Information Act requests, which cost the tiny school district over $500,000. Now the school is suing these parents, claiming that their requests are crippling the district of only 112 students.
Wow.
Is this an example of parents making informed decisions about their children, or do these requests go too far?
Wow.
Wow.
Well, both Mike and I spent some time at the U.S. Department of Education, so I guess I have some mixed feelings about FOIA requests. But the truth is, I don't think most people realize that if someone submits a FOIA request, by law, the department has to take it seriously, and it takes a whole lot of man hours to actually reply to these things. So if a small group of parents and the school district's only 112 students, and they're filing all these complaints, I kind of have sympathy for the district, I suppose.
Right. I mean... Well, and you can understand their frustration. I don't know if they have any case to sue against these parents, and because the law is the law is the law, and it doesn't really, you know, it maybe works for big agencies which can suck it up
right.
In terms of the man hours. It's not going to work for a little tiny district. And I got to admit, I can't wait to submit some FOIA requests to the Department of Education about Race to the Top. We're going to have a field day with that.
FOIA is important. It makes sure that people can look into what big departments are doing. But 1,000 requests a district with 100 kids?
Yeah. So I can't wait for the FOIA request, because when you know, a state like Ohio gets funded in this first round, which, you know, if this happens and we want to say, okay, what were the deliberations like? And, you know, how much, you know, evidence is there that this was horse traded for votes for the healthcare bill from on the fence Ohio Democrats. You got to know this kind of stuff's going on right now, right?
I'm actually more interested in the conversations that happened pre-decision. So when the department had conversations with whether it's foundations or nonprofit groups or unions saying, okay, what should the application look like? That's going to be interesting. Well, I think that our rookie questioner did a pretty good job.
Excellent, Marissa. I liked it. A very straightforward delivery, not a lot of flourish.
Yeah, but very subtle.
But that's good. I think that's understated, gets the job done. She let the questions be the star.
Really. Well said. Know? All right, we'll give your evaluation soon.
Okay, it's your favorite time of the week. It is Amber's Research Minute.
How you doing?
Welcome back, Amber.
Wow, thank you very much.
Congratulations on getting out the door, Fordham's review of the Common Core Standards.
That was a team effort, and we're all quite pleased about that.
And got some press.
Interpretation, it was a huge fire drill. but we got it out.
We did.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
And you have an exciting study that I even blogged about.
I think this study is fairly exciting, yes. Last week, no not doubt. So exciting. This week, just kind of ebbs and flows around here with the Research Minute, you know.
Do you have your watch out, Mike?
I do.
All right, let's hit it. This week, we have the 2009 Brown Center Report from Tom Loveless, which...
Wait, Amber.
What?
I'm sorry, I'll give you this time back. It is March 2010. That must be a typo.
Like previous reports... is a tad late.
Tad. And they call it the 2009 report. I love it. Okay, sorry.
It was already wrong. In the script, Mike. All right. Still lots of interesting data in here, all of them centering upon long-term trends. With my minute, I'll zero in on part two of the report, which asks, do schools ever change? Loveless examined roughly 1,000 schools in California that offered eighth grade in 1989 and in 2009. Test scores in 89 are compared with 09, and they show great stability. Of schools in the bottom quartile in 1989, nearly two-thirds scored in the bottom quartile in 2009. The odds of a bottom quartile school rising to the top quartile were about 1 in 70, or do the math, 1.4%. The reverse is also true, meaning two-thirds of schools in the top quartile stayed that way, with only 2% falling to the bottom quartile. Of course, it makes sense that we'd see more persistent achievement in the tails of the distribution since there are floor and ceiling effects. So the analysis also examined movement in the middle quartiles. It found more mobility there, but not a lot more. Mainly, a third stayed put, and the others moved to an adjacent quartile. Loveless concludes sadly, achievement seems to be part of the institutional DNA of schools handed down from decade to decade.
So I think this is important and amazing, and it should completely not surprise anyone because there have been tons of studies that have shown this in the past, but this is just the latest and has the most stark numbers. And I don't think we should be sad by his final take on it. It's in the DNA. It's something that we have to deal with.
Yes.
And yet Secretary Duncan and the rest of the turnaround craze people somehow think that they're going to be different than people who've tried this over the past 40 years, and we're going to invest more billions into the failed schools of yesterday, and we are going to waste human capital and time when in fact we should be closing these schools and giving kids real options instead of giving these poor kids a 1 in 70 chance of going to a top quartile school after some amount of time.
Okay, so... on the other hand,
balance show we have here.
Hand, I mean, to call this a turnaround issue, we're talking about a 20-year time lag here. That would be a long turnaround.
True.
Look, doesn't this mean, first of all, that really that what's happening is that the neighborhoods haven't changed much in 20 years? And if we're just looking at test scores, we're not looking at change over time. We're not looking at value added, at growth, at anything else. We're just saying, yeah, you know, kids in these neighborhoods are still scoring low. And so lo and behold, probably that means these poor neighborhoods are still poor. I mean, he didn't try to look at any kind of progress or...
No.
So and we know that, you know, what drives achievement more than anything else, sadly, is student demographics and socioeconomic status. So it just seems to say that, look, you know, these neighborhoods that are not doing... These schools are not doing well are in neighborhoods that are stably low income, or at least the kids that are going to public school in those neighborhoods are... coming from low-income neighborhoods.
So Mike and I go back and forth on this all the time. Yes, wealth and race are statistically significant variables when it comes to student achievement, but they are by no means determinative. And there are many, and you and I can debate about how many, but high-performing, high-poverty schools. So it can be done, and the fact that these schools aren't improving just means that we need to get rid of them, shut them down. And yet we won't do that because for some reason we believe that we're going to be different and we can turn this around.
But that's the same argument back, is saying, you know, we're going to put a new school in those neighborhoods, and our hope is that they will be dramatically better. And some will. And look, we've got, 300 or 400 schools around the country that are showing us that they can do dramatically better.
Far more than that.
I don't know. Amber, anything else you'd like to say?
I love when you guys just fight.
It
really adds to the show. Well,
when we disagree, I think it's actually good.
And I think you both have really good points. That's why, you know, I enjoy just sitting right in the fence in the middle of you. It's great.
Yeah.
No, we
debate,
right?
All kinds of things. I mean, so for example, I've been saying all along that what Tiger Woods did was horrible. And yet Andy, he's trying to stick up for him.
Right.
I don't get it.
I don't remember having that conversation.
All right, Amber. So what is the song that goes along with this?
So this was tough, but I had some help. Since we have the Brown Report, we have the Godfather of Soul, James Brown, with Night Train.
Oh, I feel good. Miami, Florida. Atlanta, Georgia. Raleigh, North Carolina. Loving that soul. You
good
know, I suggested, you know, I feel good, but turns out we don't have the rights to use that song.
Yeah, and all of our listeners should know that we assiduously follow the rules.
We do.
On these things. Hey, Janie.
Hi. That was the first time I ever got to listen to the music. It was very exciting.
So you got promoted this week.
I did.
That's awesome.
It's time for Rate That Reform. Andy followed the rules and did not talk over the music. Thank you.
I like talking over the music. So you've never heard that song before?
Well, not sitting in the seat now. I mean, I've heard it on the actual podcast, but it's much more exciting in the seat.
It is when you get the cans on your ears.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, Janie. So Janie in the seat for Stafford this week, and you are going to rate a reform. I understand it's actually a real reform that we're going to rate.
A little bit, yeah, more so than usual.
Not just like some absurd happening from around the country. Don't take that the wrong way, Stafford. I actually tend to prefer it when it's just absurdities. But go ahead, Janie.
I hope I don't disappoint you then. With 220 schools offering single-sex classrooms across the state, South Carolina is the nation's leader in offering a single-sex option in public schools. But recently, facing continued financial strife, 60 South Carolina schools have decided to drop the in-school choice program. These schools recently lost teachers due to budget cuts and now say that they no longer have enough teachers to cover both single-sex and co-ed classrooms. The total number of schools offering single-sex classrooms options is expected to fall to 100 by the upcoming school year, says the state's single-gender coordinator about the fragility of the program, quote, "We're not federally funded, and we're not a state mandate," end quote. I'm a little conflicted about this reform. Schools across the country are facing budget cuts, obviously, and it's well known that, you know, the lion's share of these budget cuts go to teacher salaries and benefits. So if South Carolina is responding to budget woes by effectively removing the state's worst teachers, you know, I would definitely back that. But at the same time, I think school leaders should really try to find ways to do so without affecting kind of like unique and, in this case, pretty popular choice programs and, you know, individual programs in schools. So it seems to me that the schools could find a way to have teachers teaching both co-ed and single-sex classrooms, and that the existence of these single-sex programs do not need to be an additional financial burden over regular classes. So I'll admit that I'm a tad biased, having gone to an all-girls high school myself, which I thought provided for a very tight and close-knit and comfortable atmosphere without the distraction of pubescent, hyperactive boys.
Whoa.
Which is your main complaint about the Thomas Lee Fordham Institute's working environment at this point.
So
especially when Rick's here on the show.
I give the reform a C minus. Yeah. I just added the minus myself. I like it. I'm feeling more negative about it now that I've read it.
C minus.
Pot shot at all boys. You're coming hard. I like that.
Completely
fair. I will admit
completely
you,
fair, no doubt.
My high school class, very, very close. We all, you know, 106 girls all loved each other, you know, very close. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that it was all girls and that you were sitting in class and you could joke around with each
and
other.
And it wasn't like Mean Girls or Heathers,
no, actually,
none of that stuff?
Not in my particular class. Other classes around us, maybe a little bit. My class, we were pretty sweet.
People who read the blog know that I have been obsessively going over Race to the Top applications.
Obsessively,
no doubt about that. I admit I have a problem. But one really interesting thing is how, even though there's Race to the Top money involved in this, how completely unwilling states are, even though the application asks for it, to get serious about using evaluations to get rid of low-performing teachers. So the point you raise is actually an interesting one. Here's a case where a state has the opportunity to get rid of some teachers, unfortunately, but rather than focusing on the lowest performers, they decide to get rid of choice-based programs that might actually be serving a lot of low-income kids or all kids very well.
Well, here's hoping we can find some other ways to divide children up by gender. Maybe, yeah. You know, on school buses, we could have a boy's side and a girl's side.
That happens naturally.
Oh, that already happens. Yeah. Lunchrooms. Oh, wait, that already happens. Cafeterias. All right, Janie, very nicely done. Nicely played. Andy, it's always a pleasure.
It's always great to be here.
Yep. But
even when you tell me I say awful things about Tiger Woods.
Well, you can reconsider if you'd like. But until next week,
I'm Andy Smerick.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, always here at edexcellence.net, signing off.